For us, it proved to be a really fertile number of years relative to growth. There's always opportunity in adversity, always, right? Even now where we're at, you know, like there's opportunity everywhere, I personally believe.
Welcome to this week's Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me, Gary Fox. This week, we have a podcast I've wanted to do since I started this podcast 3 years ago. I sit down with Kieran Crean, the co-founder of Mixed Garage. Mixed Garage is one of the pioneer companies in Ireland in the online space. They started way back in 2004 and they're absolute pioneers from a technological point of view, but also they're mentors and entrepreneurs that a lot of people in Ireland look up to and aspire to be, myself included. This is a great chat. He's an absolute gentleman. He breaks down the mistakes they made along the way, the growth they've had, how they've bought back the majority of their company from early investors, and how it's now spun off a brand new company that could be absolutely huge. Enjoy my chat with Kieran Crean, the co-founder of Mixed Garage. Thanks to my partner, Square. Everything your business needs, like payments, point of sale, e-commerce, inventory management, chatting endlessly about the weather? Well, you're on your own there. Square. Everything your business needs. Almost. Visit square.com. If you're a regular listener of the pod, which I hope you are, you'll know I've been hosting the podcast from Iconic offices for quite a while now, and things have gone really, really well. So well, in fact, that I'm now a member of Iconic offices, working and recording from one of their spaces. This means I can vouch for the benefits it gives to any business. On that note, Iconic offices have given me a number of exclusive complimentary day office trials for my audience. So try it out for yourself for the day. Bring your team. No catches. Simply go to the web link in the description and enter Gary23, so it's Gary23, to claim your complimentary office for a whole day. It's a pretty fantastic offer. Thank you, Iconic offices. Now, on with today's episode. Kieran, welcome to the pod.
Thanks very much, Gary. Great to meet you.
You have been on my list for a very, 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 very long time.
If that's a worrying thing or not.
The naughty and nice list. You're on the good list. Welcome.
Thanks very much.
I'm thrilled to have you. Genuinely, like, your story and the story Mixed Garage is one of the original founder stories in Ireland.
Yeah, we've been chucking along now for quite a while, you know, so we've certainly been part of the furniture, I think.
When did it start?
February 2004.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how did it start?
Oh God, it's a bit of a long story. I think, you know, it was probably started by my brother Mick and I.
The clue's in the name, yeah.
Well, exactly.
He got his name on the door first.
Exactly. So we were both in the IT space, right? So, I was a kind of CRM implementation consultant and he was a developer with the company Phineas. And, you know, if you remember, over in a, it used to be Managed Solutions Corporation. And, you know, I think we always wanted to do something for ourselves, right? You're at that age where you didn't really give a damn, you know, with it was felt at the time with IT skills, you could fall into any door. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if we failed, so what, right? So Mick decided that he wanted, overnight decided that he wanted to learn how to develop websites. So, and if you're going to develop a site, you got to put down it, right? And Mick's original formal training came from Bolton Street, where Department of Transport, where he had a ground in the automotive industry. And so it was probably the only product sector that any of us knew, and he knew it.
Okay.
So we decided, well, let's decide. I'm going to create a website for the crack, and I'm going to put parts on it, and we'll see how we go. And then he actually put it live, right? Where we had a form on the website. We put the basic products live. We had a form on the website launched in I think 1st of February 2024. And where the form was literally, it was just a form, right? So we would get an email with credit card details, an email with an order come in. And at that time we had the simpler phone, but you could set up on your Vodafone phone where if you got a specific email, the phone would chime to say you've got, with a text to say you got an email from sales@mixgarage.com, which for us was, I think it was actually order@mixgarage.com, which recognized the order. So we put it live. I think within 3 weeks, we got a first order. And it basically went ping. And I went, oh my God, we actually got an order here, right?
The magic feeling.
The magic feeling, you know. And I think we got 3 to 4 orders the following month in March. And I remember, like, we celebrated wildly and Ranelagh probably spending the next year's profits just for that. And then ultimately, you know, we just kept it there, made sure. So all orders are drop shipped from suppliers, right? So we literally, it was your typical bedroom operation where the order would come in, we would get an email with credit card information at the time. I mean, there was no Stripe, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. We had a credit card terminal connected to a phone line in the bedroom. We would key in the information, your credit card number, expiry date, bang, you get the receipt. Receipt, we'd go, yeah, that's gone through. We would send the order to our supplier and they would send it then directly to our customer.
The ultimate best business model, yeah, right? Didn't have to carry stock, didn't have to do anything.
Yeah, yeah. So that's how it started. That's basically how it started. Mick did it because he wanted to learn how to build websites and engineer that type of structure. We put automotive part on the site and we started selling.
If you're starting it again, would automotive parts be where you'd start?
Probably not. Automotive products have a certain complexity to them, right?
I couldn't believe this. You were telling me this over breakfast. I couldn't believe how complex it is.
Yeah, so
different varieties.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you think of the various elements of parts, right? Even from a braking system, right? You got your brake pads, your calipers, your discs, your fitting kits, your splash panels, your brake shoes, and any number of brake pads, right? So let's just take, for example, a set of brake pads or a brand of brake pads. So it could be Brembo or it could be Bosch. And that brake pad would probably have the best part of 12 to 1300 references to cover most of the cars in the European market, right? So that's one set of brake pads. And each of those brake pads can suit a particular amount of cars. So, for example, BP 120, right? So that's a set of brake pads that would typically fit Volkswagen, Audi, and Skoda cars. Fits about 1,213 models. So back to the big picture. When you step back and you look to say, right, well, look, that's only one set of brake pads, one brand of brake pads, 1,200 parts. On our Mixed Garage database at the moment, we have over 1 million parts live, right? So that's, take that brake pads and even say we might have 8 brands of brake pads. That's part of 10,000 part numbers you have live only for brake pads, right? So if you multiply that by all the components that's available in that car, it gets to a hefty number of parts, right? So that's nearly 1 million parts. And then you multiply that by the number of models or car models that each part will fit. And we have a search index of 42 million listings, right? Which is parts multiplied by cars. So yes, there is a certain complexity to sell an automotive product to ensure that you've got the correct part listed against the correct car, and also then to provide the user experience to allow the customer then to buy that product, right? So there is a fair bit of heavy lifting in that. You know, very often we'd come across sites that, you know, might have 5,000 or 20,000 products, right? And we're going, ha, you know, is that all? You know, but for that, I mean, the very real challenge, and I suppose it lent very much on our technical chops, is that we had to build an infrastructure to support that and drive that, right? So, you know, Shopify were us at a time, but certainly there was other e-com platforms that were available to us, neither of which could suit the purpose that we were looking for, given the complexity and the depth of products. So to answer your question, would we have started with car parts as a first test, just to try a test website? Probably not.
At what stage did you and Mick kind of look at each other and go, I think there might be a business here. I think we might actually have something.
Yeah, well, I think when the first order came in, right?
You know, you knew straight away, you're like,
such a buzz. There's such a buzz. Okay. And even now, you know, we're e-commerce guys. Like, we love product and boxes. We love product and boxes, and we love getting them out to customers. You know, so like, you know, like, we put up a new range of filtration there a few weeks back. So K&N filtration, it's a premium brand filtration, right? So it, you know, lasts the lifetime of the car. We put that live. We got the product in, and when the first sale comes in, the whole office goes, we almost should have a bell, you know, like the sales room bell. Ding, ding, ding. I get a kick out of it.
You still get it even now. That's amazing.
Even now.
That is amazing.
I love it. I love it. Absolutely love it. Say, oh God, you know, we might have identified a product set. You know, we'll ask procurement to go and get that product set, or indeed get a range similar to it. We'll bring it in, we'll go onto warehouse, we'll put the content together, get the images, get the video. You put it live in the first index and you're kind of going, right? You know, is it going to be a sale? And even now, yeah, your first one comes in, you go, oh, that's fantastic. That's brilliant, you know?
How magic is it though to do that, do something you love like that for a job? You get to go and you still get the buzz. It still gives you that little kick.
Love it. Absolutely love it. Yeah, love seeing product at the door. Absolutely.
So you fantastic. And Mick were pretty much determined from the first sale that this is going to become a thing.
Yeah, but again, Gary, we didn't have very much to lose, you know? I'm sure you've heard it many times. Like, we were young, we weren't married, we didn't have a mortgage, we didn't have kids, right? So I think we kicked off at 27. And so we didn't really have a huge amount to lose. And we were confident in our own ability that if it fell over, you know, hey, what the hell, right? But once the first order came in and the second and third, like, we kind of felt that, you know, when you start something, you have to see it through, right? You know, you can't just start something and sell product to customers and then just take it down, right? I mean, that doesn't jive, right? So we decided that we would, like, kind of formally look at what we can do here. So we had a pal whose father was working within the, like, enterprise networks in Ireland, right? So we met with him and he said, look, if you're interested in, perhaps you should look at getting into one of the startup programs, right? And back then, you know, 2004, there wasn't a huge amount out there, but there was a program called Hot House, which was the genesis of the New Frontiers program, right? And that was, the Hot House was based up in a program run by the Docklands Innovation Park, co-joined with Enterprise Ireland. That was up at Eastwell Road, just behind the point, right? I think it's actually moved now. But so we did. I reached out in June. They had a new program launching in end of August, September. And, you know, they sent a form to fill up, so your basic business plan. And I still have it. It's great crack to look at.
That's
right?
Cool.
And, you know, you fill up the form, you send it in, you know, who are we, what we're about, where do we see the potential, where are we going, resources, marketing, funding, all that kind of stuff. Call in for an interview. And we got accepted. So here we had an opportunity to go in a place, you know, where we were coming from very much a software background. And
what were you looking for? Like, business advice, or kind of what were you looking for?
Yeah, I suppose we were looking to see, you know, there was shitloads we don't know and we didn't know. We were looking to see, you know, probably to immerse ourselves in that world to some degree, right? Yes, we needed help. Like, you know, none of us had a financial background, a marketing background, sales background, corporate structure, etc. So for sure, we were looking for help. But it doesn't hurt to fill up the form, right? So we did that, and we were very surprised to have the opportunity to get accepted. So we had to make a decision, right? So it was one of us could do it. And I suppose it was felt that Mick is very much the technical guy relative to, I suppose, the planning of the business and everything around that. I took the lead on that. So I basically jacked in the job at the time and started with Hot House in, I think, early September 2004. Yeah.
How'd you feel?
How did it feel?
Yeah. That first day, do you remember what that felt like?
It did. It actually did. It's good crack, actually. You walk into a room, you know, and there was 14 companies there, right? So predominantly male. Actually, in fairness, there was four lady entrepreneurs there as well, right? And I was like 26, and I was very much on the younger side, right? And back then, you know, there's a couple of entrepreneurs, and like it was about WAP technology, right? So we're going back here a bit, Gary, but a lot of it's very traditional industries, you know, you know what I mean? A lot of it's very traditional industries. And I remember going in and sitting down, and I sat down around tables. There was a number of tables, and four of us to a table. On my right hand side is a French guy, Olivier. And Olivier, I'd say at the time, was probably closer to 40, which is young now. But, you know, I remember saying, hi, my name is Kieran, good to meet you. And I remember leaning over to me and going, like, in a very heavy French accent, you know, this is my third business, and if this doesn't work, I'm never doing this again.
It's day one, Olivier. Right, give me a break, all right?
Yeah, a great, lovely
tone down chat. The intensity by a five.
And that was the first day. So, but I remember being in a room and where everybody had to, you know, give an attempt at who they were, right? Stand up and introduce yourself. And which, I, you know, I never did any of that. Like, I'm a tech background. I'm in the background for a reason, right?
Okay.
And I remember getting that nervous energy, being incredibly excited about it. And you know, there's a great crack of electricity to the room. And I loved it. Absolutely loved it.
That buzz around startups is just, yeah, when everyone's just kind of in that first flush, it's
yeah, absolutely
incredible.
It is. It really is, you know. And, you know, met some great pals at the time that I'm pals with today, right? Yeah. And there's a great energy and we're all in this together. We'll all, you know, we'll all sink or thrive together, right? You know, so yeah, it's a fantastic environment to be in. It's a great start. It's a great start, you know.
And what got you guys going then? You were getting the orders, like where were they coming from, or what was kind of the path that you took to kind of get going?
Well, I think for us, it was very much about, so we were very much a dropshipping business, right? So we could run it from our office. We would put a product on the website and we would sell a product, taking the payment, send it to the supplier and they would drop it out, right? So drop shipping. And for us, it was very much about, I suppose we were kind of somewhat unique relative to our cohort within the Hot House group, because we were actually selling. We were selling products. We were grinding it out, you know?
So, this crazy thing called customers.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So we were literally grinding it out. And of course, now, you know, looking back, of course, like some of the propositions and businesses, you know, they're very capital intensive. There's R&D. So different business horses for courses, right? But, you know, the fact is we could put a product on a website and we could sell a product. So we were literally revenue generation as we were from day one, right? So for us, it was very much about, you know, certainly, you know, we had an office in the Docklands Innovation Park, and every weekend on a Friday and Saturday, there would be a two-day session like every month, either marketing, finance, etc. But in the meantime, we were engaging suppliers, putting new products on the website, you know, expanding our marketing efforts, looking to sell more product, increase our revenue, and just continue to grow it. So, you know, notwithstanding, you know, the fact that we're in incubation, like nothing beats sales. And that's what we were doing. I mean, we were so early into the online sphere that we were getting, we were very early on Facebook, for example. So we were getting a click on Facebook for a cent to go.
Wow.
A cent to go.
This is what I was curious about, because now if someone launches a business, there's very clear routes they can take.
Absolutely.
They can go Instagram, TikTok, Facebook.
Yeah, yeah,
they're very clear. We can start right now.
Absolutely.
And by the afternoon, we can be running ads and getting clicks.
Correct.
So you were getting a cent a click on Facebook. So Facebook was probably just starting to bubble up, was it?
It was. It was at its infancy. But indeed, even Google was only out the gate four and a half years, right? So, and there was very little avenues for online marketing at the time. There wasn't a huge amount. It was like your PPC, your Facebook was coming out, and then you typically bought banners on websites.
Yeah,
right? You
know, that type of thing, right? Yeah, yeah. A thousand from whatever.
Yeah, so we were...
Which is probably good and bad in the fact that you could have very clear channels. Okay, we're going to be Google and Facebook.
Yeah, absolutely. Or it was traditional media. It was traditional media, yeah. Right? So you know, we were doing quite well at PR at the time. And actually, indeed, I remember we were working. So I was working right up until I resigned to start Hot House. But there's... In that June, where we're doing the application coming through, we got a bit of PR on the Independent, right? Come out on Thursday. And I was working for a company called BMC Software at the time, you know, working with their CRM Siebel implementation throughout Europe, a satellite of a Texas listed entity. And we had a very decent full page on the paper at the time. So for a consumer, less relevant today, because for consumer business, you wouldn't necessarily think that, you know, we got to get on the paper, et cetera. It's just not where you would start your acquisition journey, right? But it was at the time, very relevant at the time, you know, radio, paper, et cetera, because that was the dominant media back then. And I remember we got a very good full page on the Independent at the time on a particular Thursday. And, you know, as normal business, you get a stack of papers delivered that morning. So I was first in the office that morning, and I don't know if anybody noticed, but that page was gone from all the papers, right? It was hard to get in and strip that from all the papers in the morning before they're put back on the front desk for anyone to pull it out, you know? But yeah, we did it wherever we can. Like, you know, Vistaprint. Remember Vistaprint? Yeah. I'm not too sure if it's still going.
I think actually. It's still going strong, yeah.
So Vistaprint was, we would buy magnet business cards, right? Magnet with mixgarage.com. And Mick and I, he lived just off the canal in our house across, and I shared a house in Ranelagh. And we would basically get these magnetic business cards at mixgarage, and we would cycle around and just attach them to all the parking meters in South Dublin. Right, so it was
guerrilla marketing. They call that now, yeah.
It was anything, right?
Yeah,
it was anything. So,
but you were just getting going. This is the bit I love about origin stories, because people look at you now and you're going, "Oh, really cool entrepreneur." You know, he's done so much, but it's the grit at the start. Mm-hmm. It's the magic. It's like they always think, "Oh, it's this sophisticated strategy." It's just getting going.
Absolutely,
getting it was your name out
but,
there.
But to be fair, we also had a minority. Co-founder, so who was involved in PR at the time, Mark, and he was instrumental at getting us off the ground, you know, getting us in the paper, the radio, etc. Right, so and we did it wherever we could, but it was very much guerrilla. So it's like online marketing at the time was cheap, so it was very much about you couldn't spend enough because there wasn't enough people buying online.
I know what you mean,
right? Yeah. You know, yeah. So and when we did, we were getting it incredibly cheap. So you know, we could sell. You know, we could sell like a headlamp for like, you know, 200 euros at the time. And the cost per acquisition, that could be 50 cents, you know. So while revenue was small, I mean, our first year revenue was 10 grand, you know, the following year was 100K. So it was small. It started to climb in such a way that we did actually have the cash flow to start to invest in various online media where we could. Right. So, but yeah, you know, like every business, you grind it and grunt it out however you can.
So you went a 10xer on the second year, 10k to 100k in the second year. Oh, yeah. What did that feel like?
I mean, it you know, I can't recall us like turn around going, God, aren't we amazing?
Probably so busy.
Yeah, but you are busy. You are busy. And I think, and even now, actually, probably a failing we have to a great degree is we don't necessarily celebrate the small achievements.
I think that's an Irish thing. I think we're all very bad at that.
I think it probably is. Right?
I think we're terrible at kind of going, oh, look, we like an Irish person's greatest fear is been told you're getting ahead of yourself.
Yeah.
Like, what are you doing? Like, we have this fear of like actually going, yeah, I did a really good job there.
Probably, yeah. So I don't recall us kind of going, woohoo, this is absolutely fantastic. It's amazing. Because like, you know, like you're only as good as next day sales.
Yeah, I think that's it too. You know, you also have the fears. Like, yeah, entrepreneur.
Year's finished grand. You know, you wrap up the year with your accountant, but you don't really care because you're doing account. You're there with the accountant. Like, he's talking about last year, you're talking about tomorrow, right? You know, so that's it. You're always leaning forward. It was a 10X. And actually, that's the first time anybody's ever said that, because it's like, so what? You know, you just keep going. And that's what we're doing. It's always, the thing about e-com is there's always a grind, a grunt. There's always something you can do to affect the sales. You can increase your acquisition. You can add more product and website to sell to existing customers, acquire new customers, head on to new media, etc. So there's always something to be done. And over the years, it's got exponentially broader. As you mentioned, you know, anything from TikTok to LinkedIn, right? The mediums have multiplied.
It's probably a blessing and a curse, right?
Well, for sure. And it was because we were early to market. The avenues for acquisition and brand awareness were a lot narrower back then. So I would say that, you know, for us as a business getting off the ground, and you know, the fact that we were so, I mean, you know, Mick didn't come on full time until, God, I think it was 2006 or so. So
you're, you know, 2 years in the business before he came in.
It was incredibly limited for resources, right? So we just grinded it out.
And then he comes on full-time 2006. Like, what was the plan? What did you want? When you were sitting in the business, what did you want from the business?
I didn't know what we wanted. That was it. We didn't know. Like, I mean, you know, like a lot of these things, you know, is there a grand plan? There's not. You know, there's not really.
I think that's what kills most businesses, right?
Yeah.
The business plan becomes this immutable thing set in stone, and they're so afraid to deviate from it that it has to be this, or they won't start until they have the grand plan.
Yeah.
Oh, once I have the vision, once the vision is clear. Mm. And I think we touched on this having breakfast. You know, there's this big fetishization about funding and, you know, getting funding and having a grand plan and having all these great names. Whereas in essence, all the great businesses just start.
Well, they do, but in some degree, particularly at that point, if you don't have a grand plan, but yet you immerse yourself in a world where it's a startup, where you're in an incubation, you engage with your local enterprise board, wherever. A plan, it's not foisted on you, but the fact that you have to do one is, right? And typically that plan always, like, why are you not raising money? Mm. You know, why are you not raising money? So the plan in the first few years was just to go along with it. You know, we were having so much crack. I mean, you know, like within the startup, within Hothouse, great bunch of people, right? Entrepreneurs are great crack. I mean, they've seen a huge amount, right? And you know, it was the social side of it was phenomenal. It was unbelievable, and the people you met were unreal, right? So there wasn't necessarily any great plan. Of course, yes, the output of the Hothouse program was that you would actually create a plan, right? So you had a 3-page sketchy plan to be accepted, to be considered, to get in. But the output was, now you've done your sales weekend, and now you've done your finance weekend, and your marketing weekend, and your management, your resourcing weekend. So we like a plan, please, right? And invariably, when you're in a room, I think to a person, everybody in that room was looking for funding. Mm. So I suppose we went, well, maybe we should turn our heads towards funding, right? You know, so and so that became the plan. So Mick came on board in 2006. So our goal was to achieve a seed round. And so what we did is that we knew that we were early relative to what we were looking to do. Notwithstanding, we went from 10 to 100K, 10X. You know, that's different in perhaps a SaaS business or other industries. In e-com, that's just people buying product. Mm. You know, so for us, we felt that we had to be probably a bit further along our growth stage or our growth before we would engage with any funders. And then, you know, we were probably sort of validated on that to some degree, because we did go and talk to the early seed funders and they said, yeah, look, you need to be a little bit further along.
Right.
So when Mick came on board, you know, we kind of grinded it out to a huge degree and we brought the business up to about 400K worth of revenue.
Wow.
And on the basis of that, then we managed to do a seed round led by AIBC Capital. At the time in 2008.
And what was the money for? Was it for expansion, or was it to build a warehouse? Or what was the money for?
Yeah, it was a bit of everything, right? It was a bit of everything. It was expansion all fronts, right? So I suppose we were creaking to some degree on the dropshipping model, because the dropshipping model, you know, it fails where you need to put on multiple suppliers to service the same industry. So we might have a suppliers and they were doing braking parts, and you might have a supplier that was doing car mats, and another supplier that was doing car care, right? And if on a dropshipping model, each supplier is sending that product out to the consumer, and they're all, quite rightly, they're charging a delivery charge.
I get you.
So if you come onto the website at the time and you order a set of car, the worst customer in the world, while the average order value is higher, the worst customer in the world for us was someone who bought a bottle of polish, a set of car mats, and a brake pads, right?
Because they're all coming from different places and three different orders.
Absolutely.
And I get you.
Three different delivery charges, and your margin is slammed, right?
So, I get you.
So we made the decision back then to you know, get a small unit and start to stock some of our key lines. So fast movers, of course. So we did. The unit became available within the Docklands Innovation Park. So we took that. And we started to stock some of our key lines, I suppose, first getting into warehousing. So in order to, I suppose, to cash flow that, or to fund that. Yeah, we took in a seed round. You know, we did that to seed our first stock. But no, of course, we had decent cash flows coming through, albeit on a relatively low basis. So we were able to fund that from trading activities. But a seed round helped us to bring in marketing experience. It helped us to, for sure, to cash for some product coming in. We need a racking on the shelf. And just your various, and you know, the developer to come on board to help us with the infrastructure. So yeah, it helped to contribute towards expanding the business where it was at that point in time.
Yeah. The e-commerce model must have been changing rapidly at that stage. You're up to 2008 now. Like you must have seen, so 2004 to now, like the world has fundamentally changed. And we touched about this a little bit during COVID, the impact that has had on e-commerce.
Yeah. Well, it has, but the world has changed like utterly in the last coming on 19 years since we started. I mean, when we, you know, people contend now with, you know, we're in it's a bad time to raise funds. You know, the VCs are out, they're doing the valuations are rubbish, et cetera, right? When we started our seed round in May 2008, you know, Lehman's collapsed in 2000 in September, right? So, you know, like, the world really went to pot then, right? And then you had your credit crunch and everything around that, you know. So, but that proved to be phenomenal for us as a business because the following number of years we grew quite rapidly, predominantly because e-commerce started to explode, and also B separately is that because of the credit crunch, everybody was batting down the hatches. And therefore, the car park was getting, the age of typical car was getting older because nobody was basically buying cars.
Yes, of course, yeah.
And therefore, because e-commerce was growing, more people were comfortable buying product online. Cars were getting older, so they wanted the car mats, the polish, the wind effects, the brake pads, the oil, the blades, etc. And so for us, it was good. But, you know, I'm a believer there's always opportunity in adversity, always, right? Even now where we're at, you know, like there's opportunity everywhere, I personally believe. So for us, it proved to be a really fertile number of years relative to growth on that. And we very quickly grew from the Docklands Innovation Park, was 2,000 square foot, and we moved out to a unit in Park West in Dublin 12 near the Red Cow, and we took on an 8,000 square foot facility, right? And we took on more product and we got to different areas, et cetera, and took more people into business just continually growing it, right?
The sky is always falling if you listen to like the wrong people.
Yeah.
There's it's always like terrible. Things are terrible for a different reason, you know, all the credit crunch, all this, after COVID now, no one's giving out any money, all the recession is coming. Mm. You'd never start a business if you listened to the mainstream narrative.
Yeah, you wouldn't. Yeah, you wouldn't, but like, you know, I typically don't like to hang around with those type of people, right? Now, let's be honest about it, like, because I think, when you kick your business off, I think you're always an optimist. You really are, probably to a fault as well.
I think you have to be. You have to be a bit naive. You have to be, you know, or an optimist and a realist rolled into one.
Well, you do, and you know, like, The Mick and I come from a background where you know, hard work was always there, and you know, if anything, we're workers, right? So we may have missed the track on a number of, you know, strategic decisions or got some decisions wrong or right, but the fact is we were workers. It doesn't make a difference, you know. You just put your head down, you crack on with it, right? And yes, there's always opportunities, you know, to capitalize either on acquisition side or to acquire a new brand or to bring a new supplier on or to launch a new market, or that product set is really striking chord in the US. Let's leverage a bit on that and see, can we bring that from $10,000 to $30,000 a month, right? Or indeed, you know, even new businesses, which I was chatting to at lunch over where we've just launched a new, well, probably 18 months now, a new SaaS product, and that's directly coming out of COVID, right? You know, so I think over the years, you know, hard work, great, taking the opportunities when they come, don't let the knocks, for us, don't let the knocks, I mean, it sounds like I'm someone up here, but I'm not, right? But like,
we've got another half an hour to film, mate. Yeah, Kieran, don't wrap it up yet.
But, and actually, a lot of people tend to call me Mick, interesting, but again, don't, like, you know, like we've been on such a journey where we've had the credit crunch and come up to 2012, 13, 14, and we've certainly had cash flow issues over the time as well. And that does take a knock on your confidence, and for sure it does. But it's always been underpinned by the fact that you know, we're there, and we're always happy to grind it out and push through it, push through it, and that's probably stood us well over the years.
If you were going again, which you kind of are, would you raise funding this time around?
I think that's a really good question. That's a really good question.
Thanks.
Yeah.
I get one every interview. I tend to have one.
It's multifaceted, right? It is multifaceted.
Because it's so contextual, right?
It is. It really
give me your overview on it.
So I'd say yes and maybe. And that's a mid-of-the-road answer.
The usual answer is, it depends.
And our journey is, right? Our journey is, yes, we did a seed round in 2008, and we also took on a larger fund led by Investec in 2012. And then we did an EIIS round in 2016. And 18 months ago, 19 months ago, we did a management buyout where we took out the majority of all investors, right?
Mm. So, and this is kind of where I wanted to drive towards. I was kind of leading that narrative along to kind of understand, because I think that's really interesting. Like, a lot of people would look at your business and not know all that had happened. For entrepreneurs and probably seasoned entrepreneurs who are on the road, talk us through that. How does that happen? How do you like raise seed, raise fund, and then management buyout again? Like, how do you get to that journey?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, we've been on the road for so long, right? That you know, particularly e-com, and the fact is that, you know, when we pitched up, seed round was great. We grew the business significantly, and then we raised a multi-million euro round in 2012. When in reality, e-com was starting to explode, right? So we were raising, like, you know, 2.3 million at the time. Our competitor in France raised 25 million, right? You know, so another competitor in the UK raised 15 million. You know, so if you're going to raise and go down a route or a plan that involves funding, I think you need to make sure that you know exactly what the market is doing and that you have enough in the tank to support a strategy, particularly if you're going head to head with larger incumbents who can potentially run at a loss a lot longer than you can. Right.
Mm.
So for us, you know, we raise money based on the plan. We execute on that plan post fundraise. And quite clearly, for us, that plan didn't work. It's as simple as that. And we found ourselves in, I suppose, you know, cash flow with cash flow issues very, very quickly thereafter that.
What was the plan?
The plan was that we would go on an acquisition spree, right? And I think a number of factors is, yeah, we showed great growth, profitable growth right up to then. We felt that in order to go on an acquisition spree of, sorry, consumer acquisition track, that we had to, you know, free delivery started to become everything. So we had to do free delivery, right? We had a product that we needed to be more competitive on. So, you know, we're going to drop our margin from X to X, right? And what that brought consumer behaviors, that actually led to a consumer behavior, a heavy operational cost, a heavy customer acquisition cost, and behaviors that ultimately weren't profitable. They just weren't profitable. And for that, it became quite apparent that we couldn't continue on that track, because we didn't raise 25 million so that our shareholders could fund someone's brake pads in a car, right? Like, ultimately. So for that, you know, we had to literally pull the brakes on that and bring the business back to, I suppose, sound financial principles.
That must have been challenging, because you've set down this road of, like, aggressive, let's go at it, to then rein it back in.
Yeah, it was challenging. It was incredibly difficult for Mick and I. Like, we had to, you know, we resourced heavy on the back of it. So we had to retrench back from that. So you're talking about, like, great employees with livelihoods, et cetera, right? So we had to probably reduce our workforce by a third at the time.
Mm. When was this?
Regroup. 2013.
Okay.
We had to retrench. And all at the same time, ensuring that we had the plan to grow out of that. You know, but ultimately, that 2012 year, 2013, because we finished the raise in 2012, ultimately that kind of stood us, because the following 2 years, we grew 40% a year.
Wow. What changed?
The year after 2013, 13, 14, 15, we grew 40% a year, predominantly because those customers that we paid, we gave our margin away to acquire, come back to us again, again, again.
Right. Because so it kind of worked eventually.
It did. We just probably didn't have the muscle to continue to go down that track, right?
Is being based in Ireland a disadvantage?
For e-commerce, for sure. There's no doubt about that. You have to contend, you know, certainly if the Ireland is your largest market and you're basing off the economics of your sales and trading in Ireland, well then, you know, you're not procuring at the same level as a competitor in France or the UK. You know, you don't have the same audience, right? The same consumer base. We looked at one point and we very decent penetration in Ireland. And if we took the same percentage across the penetration in Germany, for example, we would have been $250 million business, right? So, you know, I would look at the whole, if I was starting up a new e-commerce entity tomorrow selling product, we would certainly change track on that. I mean, there's a whole host of contexts on that, right?
What would you do differently?
Well, I mean, you know, selling other people's product, you're only ever going to win a margin. You know, so, you know, do you go down to your own brand level where it's protected, it's completely defensible, right? Where the margin is higher, but certainly the capital outflow to support that is also a lot higher, right? You know, do you decide to start a business or pitch up in the UK where you've got, you know, 60 million consumers? So for sure, there are a number of elements. And again, it's very industry specific. There's a number of elements you would do differently on that. But yeah, it is very challenging, and I'd say damn near impossible to build an incredible scaled business, e-com business selling product out of Ireland.
I think that's a key insight, though. I think a lot of businesses shouldn't be started in Ireland, maybe, you know, if new entrepreneurs are thinking. Did you and Mick ever think, do you know what, we're going to have to leave, we're going to have to go somewhere else?
As in like...
Move the business.
Pitch up. Yes, we did. And again, you know, we've been in it for a while, so there's probably nothing we haven't tried, right? So, you know, we secured a warehouse in the UK. So the logical thing was, you know, to put a product on the ground in the UK. We secured a warehouse in the UK, but a number of things played into that. So we signed the lease 6 weeks before Brexit, the vote, right? So you look at...
Were you gambling? Were you kind of going, it's never going to happen, lads?
Yeah, well, I mean, who would have thought? Right, who would have thought? But like, you know, it's you put your head down, get on with it. I mean, you're not going to, you know, we found a great facility. We had a plan to put ourselves in the UK. We can offer next day delivery to our UK consumers. We can buy product off local supply, which gives us better margin potential, right? So all those kind of good things. You're in a bigger market. But the UK is a phenomenally competitive space, right? Phenomenally competitive space. And so we signed 5 weeks before Brexit. But I suppose the biggest issue we had with that was the fact that, I don't know if you recall, but the year leading up to Brexit, and probably before that, the sterling exchange rate was down at probably 0.73, 0.74, right? So we basically had a business plan based on, and yes, we had, you know, variances and risks mapped out, but we never accounted for a sterling rate to head up to 0.9. Almost overnight at that rate, it almost made a reason to be on the ground. It disappeared.
Right.
Your margin's pulled down by 20%. Mm. And in at 20% in a very competitive space, a very competitive part space in the UK, that 20% is incredibly significant. It's incredibly significant. So we gave it a number of years. We cracked at it. We tried to buy product better, get an own brand product, etc. But eventually we actually retrenched from... We shut down operations in the UK. Now, we still have a very significant business in the UK. You know, it's worth about 20, 25% of our business, right? So, and that's all shipping from Ireland.
Right.
Which has got increasingly difficult relative to Brexit and the customs and the borders and institutions. It got more expensive, et cetera. But with our new MD on board, Barry, as of last year, we now did a full review of the UK. So why did the UK not necessarily work for us? And I suppose one of the core reasons we came to was, you know, we were looking to take Mick's Garage into the UK. And Mick's Garage has a phenomenal product set, right? It has, I think we've got over 1,200-1,300 ranges on the site. So everything from brake pads to window fletchers to car mats to polish to snow socks to roof racks, wing mirror components. So incredibly broad product set, right? And what we felt was that in hindsight, that the lack of focus on any single product sector within the UK didn't stand us well.
Right. So you would have had to niche down within the auto industry?
Correct. Yeah, correct. Wow. So what we've actually just done probably not joint venture is probably too heavy a word for it, but we've done an agreement with a business in the UK that has three warehouses, and that they've got nearly 250,000 square feet across the three warehouses. But they're looking for space in Ireland. And so we have a secondary warehouse in Ballina with additional space. So we've agreed to provide each other space in both our warehouses to pick pack product at a very, very low cost to each other. Almost insignificant. No one, as our partner says, no one's looking to make money off the pick and pack.
Yeah.
He wants to get his space over the Brexit wall, get his product over the Brexit wall into Ireland. So we're giving him space.
That's into Europe for him, is it?
No, into Ireland.
Or just for Ireland?
Just for Ireland.
All right, okay.
Just for Ireland. And we want to get our product on the ground in the UK. So we are launching, over this year, we will launch four dedicated specific verticals in the UK market.
Okay.
To go at those verticals. So late last year, we launched carracks.co.uk.
I was going to ask you, what is it to the man in the street? What's a vertical?
Yeah, so a vertical is car racks.
Right.
So roof racks, bike racks, and everything to do with the travel sector and everything on that. We're launching wingmirrors.co.uk. So it's wing mirror components.
Okay, so you're getting that specific.
We're going that specific.
Right.
Yeah. So we're launching four verticals.
That's a key insight, I think, for entrepreneurs listening, going, you have to be so... Because people would look at it and go, it's a garage. How much more niche could it be?
Yeah.
But you have to go right down into
it. You have to
verticals.
Go right into it. But you can do that. I mean, there's incredible businesses within the UK that thrive and grow on a vertical sense. I mean, there's even a competitor business over there, sparkplugs.co.uk. They sell spark plugs. and a spark plug could be anything from a pound 28 to 35 pounds.
Now that's niche.
You sell spark plugs. There's 32 million cars in the UK. Right, there's 2.5 million.
I suppose,
Do you know what I mean? Right, so we've decided that for us, it's not the broad brush in the UK. Mixed Garage will continue to deliver product and acquire customers in the UK.
Yeah,
but for us, the real to hit the nail home in the UK, it is very much our vertical launch in the UK that we will be driving. So if you want wing mirrors and you're sitting in Leeds, you come onto our site and it'll be everything about wing mirrors and just wing mirrors, yeah. Right?
Okay.
And we're going to be driving that home. And also through our relationship with our new partner, we will have product on the ground in the UK, offer next day delivery to anywhere you want.
So you're getting it fast.
Exactly. Yeah. So again, we'd like to think that we have the lessons learned of our Brexit entry into the UK. So as opposed to broad brush, we're going vertical and we're hitting the hammer home.
But that's such a great insight because, you know, you'd kind of think, oh yeah, go to the UK, but go to the UK and there's so many varieties of how you can go to the UK. Mm. You're going to have your own warehouse. You're going to get someone else's. You're going to be niche. You're going to be broad. Like that's such a great insight.
It is. And but there's also, as with anything, right, you know, any new initiative typically would have like an operational overhead, right? You know, the operational requirement grows exponentially. How are we going to do this? And again, we might chat about it a bit, but all the technology within MixedGarage.com is proprietary, right? Mm-hmm. All the way from our data product management system, all the way through to the website. And, you know, we're at the moment, you know, the verticals are going to be carved out of, so it's going to be Mixed Garage skinned down, a new domain, but it's coming from the same product engine.
The infrastructure is there.
So we can wield any of our product textures. So if we want to launch, you know, if we want to launch pizzatbrakepads.co.uk tomorrow, we can do that without having to resort to integrate it directly into Shopify or Magento and the costs associated with that. So all the verticals will be a proprietary website driven through our local engine. And, you know, if we wanted to, you know, as I say, pizzatbrakepads, brake pads, but if you really want to get really granular, you can into it. Of course, there's an overhead to that in that every website needs to have a marketing strategy bolted onto it and all the acquisition piece and all the kind of payments and then bringing it back to your accounts and tying everything together, right? Mm. So the more you launch, the more complexity and overhead you introduce into the organization. But for us, we're really, you know, carrx.co.uk has been brilliant for us last year. And our conversion rates relative to mixgarage.com heretofore in the UK are a light year different. Because what we're doing is we're telling the consumer in the UK that, look, there's roof racks. We're the experts at those. Look at the pictures of what we're coming through. And by the way, if you've got a question, come and ask us, right?
It makes such sense. Like, we are what we are. This is, there's no confusion about, because sometimes you do go to an e-commerce site and you're like, oh, it's just too much. Just the choice is just too much. People want very clear decisions. I want to talk to you about the proprietary technology and kind of move our way towards your new business. Talk to me briefly about the management buyout you did a couple of years ago. What is that? What is a management buyout? Because I think if to the man in the street listening to you and looking at your story, you'd imagine you owned the whole business.
No, not at all. So, I mean, you know, we went through different funding rounds and there were equity rounds, right? So as part of that, you're carving off a piece of the pie to a great, well, sorry, that's what you're doing, right? You're handing over equity to a new shareholder in return for capital to grow the business. So we did that on, I suppose, three separate occasions over the years. And the opportunity came around. So management buyout is where you buy out shareholders, you buy equity. In turn, you buy equity from the business. And the opportunity came around in that one of our, I suppose, lead institutional investors were closing their fund down. They were leaving the market.
Right.
And as part of that, and as was their right, they formally requested that we would offer the shares to all shareholders, because within the constitution, it had to go to existing shareholders first. And, you know, there wasn't any interest, bar Mick and I. But we're sitting here thinking, okay, how are we going to do a multi-million raise here to buy these out here, right? When we didn't have any personal capital to go to that. So we had to start exploring options to do that. And actually, indeed, the morning the offer was put around from the board to all shareholders, I was reading an article in The Currency. And it was about this gentleman called Conor Sheehan in CKS Finance. And, you know, he is a financier with a corporate finance boutique agency that had experience on both sides of the table. So as a CEO and on the other side. And he just looked like a firebrand, which kind of suited Mick and I, because
a fellow rebel.
Well, to a great degree, right? It just suited. So we engaged with CKS Finance, and we looked at various options of how to bring a finance to the table. And we looked at private equity and say, look, would they come in and take out the shareholding? But ultimately, we were just swapping one shareholder for another if we were going to do that.
Yeah. Right?
And of course, then you're looking to see, you know, can we do deals where if we allow them in to come in and take an element of the equity, perhaps, you know, we can also get a piece of that, right? So, you know, you're not just going to swap one for the other. Like, what would be the point of it?
Yeah.
So ultimately, we decided that necessarily wasn't for us, even though we met some brilliant private equity houses in Ireland. And we decided that the best way to do it was for Mick and I to personally raise the finance to buy out shareholders who wanted to depart. So Conor facilitated that. We took a facility from Ulster Bank, and we made an offer out to all shareholders, and ultimately Mick and I bought back practically 80% of the business, which was great.
Wow. Okay.
It was terrific. And so that's an MBO. Basically, you raise finance to take out existing shareholders with the premise being is that you trade, you grow, you drive on, and you ultimately obviously you repay the finance and you're left with, you have a significant chunk of the business and you work off that.
You almost had a fresh start. And at what stage then did the spark come for this new idea?
Well, I think over the years, I think it's probably fair to say that probably the board we've had over the years, you know, there wasn't too many meetings where they're trying to keep us in the track, right? You know, sorry, not there wasn't. There wasn't too many meetings. There's quite a few meetings where they're trying to keep us in the tracks, right? There's always opportunity. There's always opportunity, and you know, our background is, you know, we're software. We love software. That's our background. Where we've come from, And given the fact that the mixgarage.com technology is proprietary, you know, it was built to handle product level of SKUs and database of over a million SKUs, generation of search index of 42 million listings, etc. And also the fact that, you know, a lot of our products, so, you know, we might send out, you know, any month, maybe 20, 25, 30,000 orders, depending on the season that's in it. And a lot of the product that is bought through mixgarage.com, it is literally delivered into us daily from local suppliers. So if you buy a clutch kit off us now, which is probably around 11 o'clock, quarter past 11, that order will automatically go to our local supplier, who will deliver that to us with a pallet of product. So in e-com, that's called cross-docking, and of which 37% of our business is cross-docked into us every day, which is quite hefty. So we had to build an infrastructure and a functionality that supported the volume of product, but also the fulfillment capability in order to get product at the door. Because of that and how we've done things and socializing that fact with different entrepreneurs over the year, we've always felt that there's been a commercial opportunity for the tech within the business. And we've often talked about it, but we never did anything with it because
you were scratching your own itch. You were solving your own problems. You were building all these products to use internally.
.com to grow, right? To the peaks and troughs of the years. We never had time to do it. And then COVID hits, right? And overnight, over the first weekend, everybody was buying rice and toilet paper, but over that, and business dropped 50% that weekend because nobody was buying anything
online. No one's going anywhere.
The world was going to end, right?
Yeah.
And then by the following Wednesday, of course, we were all preparing our COVID plans. Let's shut down gracefully. How do we do it here? Yeah. And then by the following Wednesday, sales literally took off.
Right? Really?
Doubled fast.
Doubled.
Like, wow. Literally doubled. Nobody was going to the shops. Nobody's going to the shops, and consumers just bought and bought online. And any business that had an e-commerce presence felt that, right?
E-commerce was your lifeline. Like, I remember, like, you'd get a package and it'd be like, oh my God, here we go. The outside world has come to
us. Right.
And you're waiting for the postman and waiting for Nick, the DPD guy, to come in. And you're like, oh my God, thank God it's here.
For everything.
Yeah.
For your daily life, to keep your, to feed your kids, to clothe your kids.
Yeah.
Like, you know, we bought so many, I've got four kids, you know, we bought so many pairs of shoes online over the course, right? You know, for garden work, for tool work, to keep your car maintained, every facet of your life had to be delivered through online, right? Mm. So our business, like, literally just took off, right?
Wow.
And as part of that, you know, Mick, who is a process freak, right? He doesn't like to see any waste of time or process or cost in any element of the business, but particularly down the warehouse. And he looked at our tech in the early days of COVID and said, look, it's great, but, you know, if we just tweak it, do this, 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 and this, we can simplify our fulfillment processes down. And that allows us to get product at the door, notwithstanding the increase of trading coming through, with very little additional resources. Because guess what? In COVID, nobody was coming to a warehouse. Mm. Like, nobody wanted to come into an environment. And indeed, our existing resources didn't necessarily want anybody new in, right? Because did they have COVID, right?
Mm.
So Mick went, did that, and he came up with a product, which we now call Wave OMS, Wave Order Management System, that absolutely did the business for us as a business. And it allowed us, the COVID years were our most profitable years, because, you know, everybody wanted product. From a promotional capacity, etc., there's loads of things you could do above the line, and you didn't necessarily have to discount as much, all that kind of thing, right? Because it was all about, not necessarily can I order it, but will it be available?
Can I get it?
Exactly.
That was the thing, can I get it?
But also, critically, we didn't have to do a linear scaling model down in the warehouse, where, you know, every 100 orders to go out the door, we had to bring in another person, because that's just a complete waste of time and inex, and it doesn't look well on the P&L when you have to look back at it. So, relative to your question, tell us about the new software, right? Very early, we got a reach out from a great business here on the East Coast, Bookstation. I think they've got 16 or 17 stores on the Eastern Seaboard and a very strong e-com business, and Madison David were looking, again, they saw their e-com, their COVID the core volume, e-commerce volume, like exponentially increased, right? Because all the stores were closed. If you needed books and stationery for your customers or for your kids or for yourself, right? You had to order online, and their e-com business took off. But as with a lot of warehouses, their pick and pack and their fulfillment on the floor is done either one order at a time. Very often it's on printed paper. So typically an order would come in, it would be downloaded, it would be printed on a piece of paper. A picker would come up, pick up the piece of paper with a basket or trolley and walk around the warehouse floor picking that order, right?
Time consuming.
Incredibly time consuming, right? So and one order at a time, right? Which is unbelievably constraining, right? You can only get out a certain amount of orders because you're literally, you're paying people to walk.
Yeah.
Ultimately.
Yeah.
That's it. And these guys are getting incredibly fit, but you're paying people to walk. And after a while, there's only so many times you can ask employees to go to the well for you relative. Let's get an extra couple of hours done here too, because that couple of hours could represent 4 kilometers.
Yeah, it's cumulative on the body and on the bottom line, yeah.
So they reached out to us completely out of the blue and said, guys, can we come in and see... can we come in and see how you guys are doing things?
So they'd obviously looked, right, who's killing it in the e-commerce space, who has the pedigree and the chops to go, they've probably figured it out and just found you.
Yeah, well, I don't know if they knew we were killing it because, you know, nobody really knows what's going on behind closed doors. But certainly we were around long enough.
That yes, said, like, you'd survived.
Yeah, exactly.
They must be doing something
exactly,
right.
Exactly, right. And so they came in to have a look at it and basically they saw, you know, they saw the way that we were engineering and coming out of fulfillment in a systemic basis. It's consolidated. You're picking all products at once in real time, a cool algorithm to sort them out and stream them to single or multi-item orders, and a cool put-wall style basis for reconstituting the orders, all done on handhelds, all done on scanning, and it doesn't require a huge amount of Johnny knowing, I know where that is. Let me just go and get that, right? You know, it doesn't require any knowledge of where the product is or that manual type of processing in the warehouse, right? All backed up with a 50-inch TV screen in the wall showing how the warehouse is performing, which is available to the managers when they're out having a cup of coffee down the road. So they came in, had a look at it and said, God, you know, we like this, you know, can you sell this to us? And we were going, no.
This was just your system. Well, you just developed this for yourselves,
was
right?
Literally take it. Was like, we've doubled overnight. You know, we're trying to operationally hold everything together while every Friday dusting off our COVID shutdown plan. Right. I suppose, as I jokingly said to you, they said the magic three words that anybody loves to hear, which was, you know, we will pay, right. You know, so, you know, Mick and I kind of sat back and went, okay, well, what do we do here? Because we've talked about, you know, realizing value out of the software over the years. Now we have the opportunity to do it. However, if we so much as go inside the door of that warehouse and put our software there, it is very firmly a new business. There's no way back. You're putting another train on the tracks and there's only one way to go and that's forward, right? So we made a decision to let's just do it.
You seem like that kind of character, though. This goes back to 2004. If you're doing it, you're doing it. You're not going to, maybe you seem like a character. If it's going to get done, it's going to get done. Yeah, we're not going to half-arse it here.
I think that's not to say I'll run into a wall, right? I think, you know, I think there's times where you have to realize that maybe we have to pull back or not. But you've no option because we're putting software into an operational critical environment.
Yes, getting, if it goes wrong, they're in major trouble.
The last step to customers, getting product out the door. So we had to ensure that the functionality was sound, that it was fully supported, that we were willing to expand upon it. And in order to do that and fund that, we had to get more customers. You cannot stop. It's a wheel. You have to keep on turning. So we implemented it into BookStation. And I think the first day that they launched it, you know, they tripled the order output on the first day.
Wow.
Right, with existing staff, right?
So same facilities, they managed to triple it just using the software.
Exactly. And so they caught up very quickly. They caught up very quickly relative to, you know, the 2 to 3 days behind. And now, you know, they're literally smashing it. If you order a book or product from them, you know, you'll get an email within half an hour to say, order goes in. It's on the way to, right? So
and that's what people demand now.
It is, yeah. But it absolutely
we've got
is,
used to it.
So it is, where is it? Has it been packed? Yes, it is. So once I get the tracking number, I know that actually it's gone, right? It's coming to me, right? So that's WaveOMS, right? So it's a basically a SaaS solution to digitally transform warehouses in the e-com and the B2B space. So if you're shifting product out to customer and you're doing it using manual processes, which is time consuming, it's costly, it's not accurate. You're sending very often send the wrong product to customer, which for e-com or for B2B is a no-no because feedback is bad and you have to correct that, which is additional cost and more resource, yeah, et cetera. Well then, you know, WaveOMS could be for you. You need to bring a systemic.
What size of kind of e-commerce businesses listening? Anything, if anyone's listening, anything, what kind of size could they?
From a B2B who is doing 700-800 hours a month, but could be churning out 45,000 units in that, right up to our heaviest business is doing 36,000 hours a month, right? Mm. So it doesn't really make a difference relative to from a size. It really depends on, you know, if you're within the pharmaceutical sector, accuracy is unbelievably important to you.
Of course,
yeah. Unbelievably important to you, right? So it really depends on your consumer requirements, the service timeframes you want to go through, et cetera, right? But, you know, we've last year we acquired and launched into 12 customers. We're currently onboarding 6 at the moment. So there seems to be quite a significant appetite.
It seems like the right product at the right time.
Yeah, for sure. But I mean, like, there's no wrong time to provide a better experience to your customers, right?
oh, I like that.
Yeah, well.
Stealing that one.
Yeah, but that's true. But for e-com, Amazon is knocking on our door, right? They're up, they've got a massive facility that takes about an hour to drive past, going out the Nace Road.
I wanted to ask you about this. The bogeyman in the room, Amazon. Yeah. What's the story?
Well, for us, we're in a sector, it's car parts. And Amazon are recognizably not great in the sector that we're in, right? To a degree that they made a strategic announcement a number of years back that they weren't going to invest in any more car parts because Amazon have a phenomenal distribution center depth across the I don't know how many million feet, right? But sure as shit, like you could fill them all with car parts and you still need more space.
I know what you mean.
Right. And equally, Amazon is an unbelievable selling machine, right? But try emailing Amazon to say, does that set of brake pads fit my, you know, Toyota iGo 1990 and does it have the fitting clips in the back of it? You're just not going to get that answer.
You have to know what you're looking for with Amazon. A book is a book, you know, a product, right. But with car parts,
you have to know what you're looking for. Yeah. So it depends where you are. You know, are you a consumer or are you a prosumer, right? Where, you know, you might go on the Bosch website and you look at the catalog and you compare the number and then you take that part number to Amazon and then I'm buying that. But if you're basically looking to buy a product where you're coming from car first, okay, what's my car? And then drive it down. It's incredibly difficult to do that.
Okay.
Where the variances, the content, the description, the information of all the brake pads, for example, for your car, it's all different. And you're getting just analysis, paralysis. They'd have a brake pad for probably, you know, 1,000 listings for brake pad for Passat. Which one's correct for your car?
Yeah.
Right? You know, so they're not great at it. Now, hopefully, whoever took over after Jeff Bezos listened to this and goes, fuck you, we're going to get fantastic at it, right? But
it goes back to your original point, though. Niche. Be niche and be bloody brilliant at it.
Absolutely. And like, you know, we have a phenomenal accessory business, you know. So yes, we do sell the Autoglym polish or the jump starter banks. And yes, we do compete with Amazon and those, right? Mm. But, you know, in particularly in a home market in Ireland, we've got a phenomenal loyal customer base who know that when they order from us at, you know, 4:30, that they're going to have it the following day, right? And that it's easy to return. You're not sending it back to the UK or wherever, right? I mean, we do compete with them on quite a lot of our product sectors, but, you know, in a lot of cases, we win. And, you know, particularly around technical product set, it is always good to have someone at the end of a chat line or end of an email where or end of the phone where you can go, does that roof rack fit my car on that, right? Mm. And equally, which we didn't chat about this morning, we launched a retail store, right? Which is off the common road, and it's focusing specifically on fitting of roof racks, roof box, bike racks, etc. Oh. Right? Because that sector is one of our core competencies, right? It's quite a significant a vertical for us. And what we're finding over the years is that one of the biggest asks we have into our customer service side is that, where can I get that roof rack fitted? Because consumers are getting less and less technical.
Well, it's one of those things, you don't want to do it wrong. You drive along the M50 and you're like, what was that noise? You see the roof rack behind you on the road.
20 years ago, the General Motors was more technical. They were willing to fit products to the car. We're losing that skill. That's just not coming through. Or they just don't have the time to do it, right? So we decided to open up a retail store that offers fitting. So on mixedgarage.com, you can basically select a roof rack and you can roof rack and box. And we'll basically, select the fitting option. We'll contact you. You can come in the following day, an hour later.
Oh, magic.
And we'll fit it for you at our store.
Yeah, that's smart.
And then to circle that around, Amazon's not going to do that for you, right? You know, so again, it is about knowing your niche, knowing what you're good at, and how do we leverage that to customers' benefit, right? So provide the advice, you know, this is how it's going to fit in your car. It's going to clip into that point there.
Yeah.
Send the fit instructions in advance. Are you happy with that, right? Confirm that it's the correct car for you, or indeed, if you want to, come on down, we'll fit it for you. Right?
That's amazing. Turn your weakness into a strength.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That was an unbelievable chat. I think we could have done about 3 hours here.
Yeah.
Where can people learn more about Wave OMS? So who's your ideal customer? I suppose give a shout out to that. Who's the kind of ideal customer? You touched on it there earlier. Who's the customer
Wave OMS, for Wave OMS? Ideal customer, anyone with the warehouse that is fulfilling product in volume.
Perfect. So like, we have a lot of quite experienced entrepreneurs that listen, so I think that'll hit home for a lot of them. And then Mixed Garage, just give that a shout out in terms of mixedgarage.com. And then yourself, where can people learn more about you?
I don't really want people to learn more about me. To be frank,
and re-listen to the pod.
I'm happy just to crack. And I was actually incredibly nervous coming today because I don't tend to do a huge amount of front of house stuff like this.
That's why I love getting people like you and hear the real story.
It's good to the chat. So nobody needs to know about me.
Okay.
They just need to know that Mixed Garage will deliver for them when they want it. And that the software will revolutionize the warehouse. And we're very happy to give a tour into mixedgarage.com if they want to come in and see it in action, or indeed visit any one of our existing customers to have a look at it.
Is there a book that's, or a podcast or any kind of medium that's had an impact on you personally or professionally?
That's a really good question. You know, I'm a huge reader, right? I'm a World War II buff. I just like to read anything.
Oh, good.
My most recent book I really enjoyed. My son bought me he said, you're easy to buy for Christmas anything that has the picture of a swastika symbol or
a
black and white picture on it, right?
You're in.
So Operation Barbarossa was a phenomenal read. Loved it.
Class.
Relative to an impact, I remember actually when the shit hit the fan, right? And you know, we had to go through a retrenchment. And there's a brilliant book called The Hard Things About Hard Things. I think you've probably heard it before, right?
Yeah, it's brilliant.
And it really, you know, it really, at that time, it probably made me realize that, you know, and again, that's the importance of networks and knowing people. Like, you're not alone, right? You know, that shit happens. That shit happens. You know, that's a fact. But you get up and you put your trousers on, you go in and you deal with it. And you deal with it front up and then you crack on, right? So that's probably from a business side, Hard Things About Hard Things, and then anything to or to on the other side. And you know, recognizing that however hard it is, folks had an awful lot harder.
Brilliant. Yeah. Kieran, that was an absolute pleasure and a privilege.
Lovely. Thank you, Gary.
Thank you so much.
Great.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Wherever you're listening, whether it's Spotify, YouTube, or Apple, click that subscribe button, and I will see you back here next week for a brand new podcast.